professional for more than 20 years. She's been creating curriculum, delivering trainings, and facilitating workshops that kick doors open in the minds of her clients. And she is a certified psychosocial rehabilitation practitioner, and she's an advanced level RAP facilitator through the Copeland Center. And she also trained me in how to facilitate RAP. And she's also a certified appreciative inquiry facilitator through the Center for Appreciative Inquiry. And she's a wife and mother of two little girls, one of whom regularly beats her at Uno despite being only 8 years old. Sounds like a smart kid.
She is. Yeah.
So let's talk about appreciative inquiry. What got you involved in appreciative inquiry in the first place?
Okay. So how it started for me is like my work within mental health, the movement that a lot of my work comes from is the recovery movement. And there's a lot of movement towards a strength-based approach. So a strength-based approach in the way we serve people, in the way that we look at where we want to go versus being tied to problems. So it's a pretty revolutionary paradigm shift within the mental health services. And honestly, not everyone is kind of on board with that, but it's really starting to change. The whole system is starting to change towards a movement more towards strength-based approach rather than medical model, problem-based services. So years ago, I was just, I love to research and Google. So like one of my favorite things to do is to just sit and go, oh, well, I'm going to look up this. And I look it up and I read it and then I read about something else. So I don't actually remember exactly how I came across it, but it was in one of those Google searches where I was looking at strength-based approaches and all that stuff. And all of a sudden this, you know, term appreciative inquiry came up and I'm like, oh, this is very interesting. And I was also a manager at the time, so I managed some staff. So I was like, is there anything I can use within this to support my staff to like have just a stronger team? So I read some books, I bought some books, I started reading about it. And it really aligned itself with a lot of what else I was working on. Like it really focuses on the strengths rather than being tied to a problem. And you're totally right. Appreciative, the word really is all about appreciating and valuing and seeing the strength. And inquiry comes from just looking at questions, asking the right questions. It's about knowing that there's more to the story and just asking questions and storytelling. It's about storytelling as well. And, you know, sometimes when you hear the term appreciative inquiry, it can feel a little bit kind of dry and it kind of feels textbooky. But when you actually get into what it's all about, it's so not. It's so robust and just full of life. And I love it. The more I study it, the more I just get excited about the concepts. It's really huge.
Awesome. So Jen, when you're talking about recovery, you're talking specifically about mental health recovery or any kind of recovery?
Well, I would say actually any kind of recovery, but my background is mental health recovery. And, you know, to be honest, I even like delving into this work, the appreciative inquiry work, it's got me thinking about even that word recovery. And how, in a way, I mean, it's called the recovery movement. It's called recovery. We all say it within the mental health system. But in a way, when you think about the word recovery, it's kind of the same as restoration. So it's like you're restoring something to the way it originally was. Whereas with appreciative inquiry, it's about going beyond that. It's about creating a new thing. So it's more generative. So it's about how do we create something else, something other. So I appreciate the language within appreciative inquiry a lot.
So Jen, on your website, luminatewellness.com, it sounds like you use this appreciative inquiry mostly in business and for managers.
Well, that's the history of appreciative inquiry. It was born, I can tell you a bit of the history if you want. Yeah. So it started in 1980 And it was discovered by this guy named David Cooperreiter. And basically, he was a PhD candidate at the time and got a job working for the Cleveland Clinic in, I believe, Cleveland. It's in Ohio, right? And he, the premise of what they wanted him to do was to look at what wasn't working within the system, what within the human system of the organization wasn't working. And so he started doing some research and started looking at, you know, basically in doing his research, he realized there was so much working. So sure, there were problems, but there was amazing things that were already happening that people weren't noticing. So through this whole thing, they basically, that's how Appreciative Inquiry was born. So it's about switching our paradigm from a problem-focused paradigm. So like, here's a problem. We have staff that aren't focused, basically. How do we engage our staff? Like, instead of like focusing on that, we want to take a different approach and go, well, what's already working here and how do we build on it? So how do we build on what is already, what's already working? So that's basically how it started. There's also a cool story I came across, and it was part of that Cleveland study. I guess the hospital bought a hotel that was, you know, for the patients' families to stay in while they had someone in the hospital. So they bought this hotel and basically kept the staffing the same, and it wasn't good. It was, people had horrible experiences. The staff were unhappy, bad service and all that stuff. So David Cooperreiter went in there and basically sent the management. So what tends to happen in a situation like that is people would go, okay, we need to replace our staff. We need to, you know, fire people and hire people who are more on board. We need to send people for training, all that kind of stuff is what the typical reaction would be. So he went in, and instead of doing that, he sent the management of that hotel to another hotel in Chicago that was a 5-star hotel. And he gave them an assignment for a week and said, you can only look at what's working in this hotel. You cannot look at what's not working. Just focus on what is working and ask questions about it. Learn about what they're doing. And don't even think about how you're going to use this back in your hotel. Just focus on the present. Focus on what's working in this hotel here and now. And then we'll come back and talk about it. So basically, that's what happened. The staff, the management came back super excited and happy and inspired. And the hotel changed fully, and it became a 4-star hotel, excellent service, and they replaced no staff. They just...
Wow.
It's just a mindset change that changed everything.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, so that's some of the history. So it typically is used within businesses and organizations. Like, we're talking high-level businesses, like Fortune 500 companies use this, this type of a paradigm. But I really think it has application beyond that. It has application in any group of individuals that gather. So any kind of organization, whether it's like a team at work, whether it's a church or a group of people who volunteer together, or any kind of club or an individual, really. All the principles apply in whichever setting.
Awesome. Now, I know that there are some steps or some aspects. I think there's 5 D's or something. I don't know where the best way to start with, but while you were talking about not replacing anyone and really focusing on what's working, we don't have to talk about this. It's a little bit controversial, but I was thinking the other day, with all of the problems that are going on with the police forces in not just in the United States, but everywhere, I was kind of thinking, well, they need to just fire everybody and start recruiting hippies and really like peace-loving people and then train them to be peace officers. But maybe even Appreciative Inquiry, if you're open to discussing it, how might you go into a police force and use Appreciative Inquiry to find how to improve it?
Wow. It's funny that you say that, because I am working on possibly doing some work with the local police force here in town.
Awesome.
But I haven't done the work yet, so I can't really speak to it. And it's not specifically about that, although everything I do has appreciative inquiry infused in what I do. But actually, this doesn't totally answer your question, but one thought that came to my mind the other day is just the whole what's happening globally. You know, globally, it feels like we're in a very dark time. We're in a time where so much bad is happening. So many things can be so discouraging, and we can get a feeling of overwhelm. We can start to go, there's no hope here. We can lose hope. We can get a defeatist attitude. I know I posted something on Facebook recently, and you know, the feedback was like, oh, that's great in an ideal world. We don't live in an ideal world right now. Those weren't the exact words, but basically, like, these are great ideas, but how will they ever be implemented? And I think the answer is, we tend to get overwhelmed by big. Like, we look at the big and we want to, okay, let's change the world. Well, how do you change the world? Changing the world is like really hard. It's really impossible when you look at it as a big picture. Same as if you're going to climb a mountain, right? If you're going to climb a mountain, you don't sit there and look, oh my gosh, how am I going to climb this mountain? You know, it's all about the small, teeny micro steps, the micro movements. So I suppose my thought around all that is, the little things really matter. The little things really matter. The way we think about something, the words we choose to use, the way we interact with all the people around us, it makes a huge impact. It makes a huge difference on the teams that we work on. It makes a huge difference in the neighborhoods, in the communities that we live in our families. So I think whether it's like working in the police force or whether it's a team that's so messed up and arguing and not getting along, it's about looking at the small things. What small things can I do to make a difference today, in this moment, right now? And eventually those things add up. They really do. And I think we can get overwhelmed by the big picture. And it's really about looking at, what can I do right now? I don't know. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, I really love that. The idea of the present moment, of course, is a big theme on this show. And it's something that I aspire to be in the present moment more often. I'm building on that skill. But what you said about the micro steps reminded me of a story about in New York City a while back. It was very, very high crime rate. And they just chose one thing to focus on. I can't remember if it was littering or graffiti, fare evasion on the subway, something small like that, that they really cracked down on. And over time, crime, violent crime actually went down. All the crime in New York City went down because they focused on this one little aspect, because that aspect added to the attitude of the people in the city. Like, if you walk through a neighborhood where windows are broken and there's lots of graffiti, the way that you view, you know, people are more likely to throw litter on the street if there's already litter on the street.
Right.
So those little things made a difference. What do you think?
Right. I agree. I think I have so many thoughts, so many big thoughts going on in my head. So one thing I've thought a lot about is just the whole fact that, like, we are made to be in community together. So we as human beings are meant to, like, live interconnectedly. And we are so influenced by each other. So like you say, like, if I say something positive or choose to reframe my language in a conversation, it's going to influence the person I'm talking to eventually. And then that will influence the person they talk to. And eventually it has a bigger cumulative effect. So those small things really matter. So I love that idea about, you know, you focus on you know, picking up litter, and eventually you get excited about other things. So, yeah, I think even if you think, I look around, you can't see the rest of my home right now.
It looks great.
2-year-old Terror, or actually she's 3, but anyway. And, you know, sometimes if we just focus on one thing, like let's just worry about the dishes, you know, let's just clean up all the dishes. And then eventually we go, okay, well, now we can clean up other things too. So it has an impact on the whole, really. And that's a simple way to almost like talk about this whole thing. It's like, one of the things that I love about appreciative inquiry is, well, there's different principles. And one of the principles is, I believe this comes from the poetic principle, and it's about what we focus on expands. Mm. So whatever we think about, it becomes bigger. Whatever we think about creates words that we use create worlds is another term that I really love. So if we're focused on what isn't working, if we're focused on all the negative things that we see in the news, if we're always focused on that, if we have like a really defeatist approach in our organizations, in our businesses, in our communities, that is going to get bigger. It's going to get worse. Whereas if we focus on the good, we focus on what's already working, then that will eventually get bigger too. So to me, that is really powerful. And there's like, I love that there's science to back all of this up too. It's not all woo-woo. I love the woo-woo stuff too. And that's partly why I love all this, is like a lot of the gurus out there who are speaking about this kind of stuff. Appreciative inquiry is really very similar to like what you would hear Danielle Laporte talk about as far as desire map goes. This came first, I suppose, and it's like really grounded in some science, and it's written, like if you pick up an appreciative inquiry book, it feels like it's written for, it's very academic. It can feel academic, but the principles behind it are not. They're not at all.
The you mentioned the poetic principle, and then there were, I think, 5 D's. So can you tell us maybe a little bit about the framework of appreciative inquiry?
Okay. So there's a history first of like how, I don't know if I need to talk about that. It's the history of like what influences appreciative inquiry first. And it comes out of a few different movements or sciences, I suppose. So one is positive psychology. So, and I've done a little bit of reading about positive psychology, and it's really, I love it even as far as like mental health stuff. So it's about not pathologizing something and just looking at the personal growth, creating new frameworks, you know, basically looking at the holistic piece of a person rather than an illness, treating an illness. So it's a bit of a switch on some of the medical models that we know. And then the other piece is there's a sociology piece that comes out that appreciative inquiry draws from. And one thing that I love is the whole Pygmalion effect. Have you read anything about that?
Can you tell us more about that?
It is basically there was a study that happened. I'm not sure when the study was. It was by a guy named Rosenthal. And I'm sure it wouldn't happen. The study wouldn't happen now because it would be considered unethical. But at the time, it was an amazing study. And it comes from like there's a history with the term Pygmalion. I think it's a poem or a movie or a book or something. I don't know. I should find it. I've looked it up, but I forget. Anyway, so they basically, the idea is we will believe let me see, you might need to edit this. So the study was, they did it with a group of teachers. So they told the teachers, they randomly selected kids and said, this group of kids are the smartest kids and really give them your attention. And this group of kids, yeah, they're not so smart, you know, and they told the teachers this. And what they found, and it was totally random, the kids weren't actually in those groups. But what they found is by the end of the year, the kids that were in the smart group were the smart kids, and the kids that were in the not so smart group were the not so smart kids. So basically, when someone believes something about you, that it will happen. So if we are, like, say in a work situation, somebody has an opinion about you and they think that you'll never amount to anything, basically their actions will almost cause that to happen. And that is, like, fascinating to me, that there's so much power because they have, you know, in the way they speak to you, in the subtle messages, the body language, will get the message that we're not valued, we're not important, and then we'll live up to the expectation, basically. And it's pretty freaky, really. Yeah.
That is perfect timing for me. I'm wondering if you can put your headphones in. I'm hearing a bit of...
Oh.
Or maybe it's okay. It sounds okay now. Okay. I'll edit that out. That's perfect timing for me because I just had my weekend job. There was someone there where there was an act of violence. Mm. And I have been viewing this person as an angry person. And I'm really trying to let that go because I know that if I view this person as an angry person, I'm going to approach them the way I would an angry person. And it's just going to perpetuate that attitude more. And really, the last thing I want to be doing is if this person does have a higher risk for being angry, mm-hmm. I don't want to bring out that anger in that person because then I'm not going to feel safe. But if I'm walking around feeling unsafe, mm-hmm. they're going to subtly pick up on that and it's going to create more tension. So I'm wondering, I imagine appreciative inquiry would probably help with that, whether it's physical violence or verbal attacks in the workplace. How do you deal with that from an appreciative inquiry standpoint?
How do you deal with, maybe repeat the question. How do you...
If there's any kind of violence in the workplace, how might a person use appreciative inquiry to shift the energy of that situation?
I don't know if I'm really qualified to answer that per se. I just think that all of these ideas will change attitudes. So if we look at the Pygmalion effect, basically we will live up to the expectations people have of us. So if there is a prevailing expectation that you're going to be violent, then you're going to be violent, right? If that's what everyone feels will happen. I think sometimes outside of this, there can be medical things going on that might be causing it. But it certainly doesn't help when people are scared and expecting it and looking at someone from a fear-based perspective. I don't think that will help someone stay calm and deal with their emotions. So I think this will help to change prevailing kind of thoughts and attitudes towards people. But I don't know if it's necessarily, because there's so many things that could cause an act of violence. So it's hard to say if it would have an effect on that. I don't know. But I think it definitely changes the culture once people are looking at it through this framework versus a framework of fear and anxiety, you know? So then some of the other roots come from like the medical system and the placebo effect. And sometimes when we say the placebo effect, you go, oh, well, fake. You know, that's the placebo effect, and we kind of tutu it or like whatever. It's like, that's, you know, it's not effective. It's, you know what I mean? So if someone says, oh, this is really working for me, and then you say it's the placebo effect, there can be a negative connotation of that. But I love the placebo effect. I think it's so fascinating to me that we can believe something is working for us and then it actually works. We can actually make it work for us. And I think that is fascinating around the power of our thinking and the power of how we can manifest things. I think it's an amazing, it's amazing. It's amazing science, really. I don't know if this fits here, but I have this book called, I don't know if you can see it. It's called The Anatomy of Hope by Jerome Groopman. And it's, he's a doctor, and he's basically studied the role of hope with people who are terminally ill. And it's amazing. I'll read this little bit from it. He talks about what is hope to him. And he came into this, like he studied this with his patients, and he came in very skeptical about the hope, and he looked at it very much from a science perspective. Well, science says that you're going to die, basically. And he noticed that the people who had a sense of hope really had a higher chance of surviving, even though it looked like they weren't going to. So he says, hope is the elevating feeling we experience when we see in the mind's eye a path to a better future. So hope acknowledges the significant obstacles and deep pitfalls along the path. True hope has no room for delusion, but clear-eyed hope gives us the courage to confront our circumstances and the capacity to surmount them. So I just love this. And I heard a story once about a guy who the doctors were saying something about his heart that was actually really negative. He was in the hospital because he had a heart problem. And they said, I forget what the term was. It was like, it's a medical term, like something like he had a galloping heart or something. I don't know if that was the term, but it was something like that. And it meant something bad. But the guy heard that and he's like, oh, I have a really strong heart. And he started to believe that his heart was really strong. And he survived. He lived through it. And I just find that just so amazing. And that's kind of the placebo effect. So sometimes when we really believe something, we can actually cause it to happen. And then also the neuroscience has a impact into appreciative inquiry too.
Awesome. I've interviewed Dr. Bernie Siegel a couple of times, and he mentioned that it's not just the hope of the patients. Obviously, their level of hope is going to affect their healing. But if the doctor has the attitude of hope for that patient, that is going to strongly impact the attitude of the patient.
Yes. Yes. And that talks about the interconnection, too, of how we, how we're influenced by other people and the Pygmalion effect. If someone says, well, you know how it is. If so, I don't know if you've had this where you're feeling fine. You're feeling like totally fine one day. And someone comes up to you and says, oh, are you okay? You look really sick. and you're like, oh, I felt fine, but actually maybe I do feel sick. Maybe I feel tired. You know what I mean? Like, it's like we can be influenced by that. And that's really huge. Whereas if someone went up to you and said, you look great, even if you're tired, and someone says, you look really great, and I see a glow in your face, that's gonna make you feel good. It's gonna make you kind of feel good. So I don't know, I love that bit.
Awesome. So I'm curious if you use, you mentioned earlier that you use appreciative inquiry. It's really influenced probably your whole worldview, I would imagine. But maybe in relationships, how can we use appreciative inquiry to improve? Like, there are so many little things that we can get stuck on when it comes to the people that we spend the most amount of time with. How has that been for you?
Right. I think one of the things that came to me yesterday is the whole idea sometimes of self-help, how it can feel exhausting because we're always looking to fix a problem. So we're always like, oh, I need to work on this. I need to work on that. And it can start to feel really exhausting. Whereas the appreciative inquiry approach is to look at what are my strengths and how do I build on those strengths. So in relationship, if we're always looking to our friends, our partners, our family, and we're thinking from the paradigm of you need to work on this, you need to work on that, even if we don't say it, even if we think it, it's going to influence the relationship no matter what. So instead, if we change our thinking to go, what can I appreciate about the people in my life today? And how do I, if they're maybe in a week, someone that you're really close to, you have one or two amazing moments and it feels like it's not enough. If you focus on those moments and focus on how do we create more of these moments, because in this moment, I feel alive when I'm with this person. And how do we have more of these moments instead of going, oh, in a whole week, I only had one time that I felt connected with my partner. You know, we can look at it that way, or we can go, in this moment, I felt fully connected. How do we create more of that? So I think it can affect our relationships hugely when we do that.
So one of the things that I've been noticing, and I've kind of understood this on an intellectual level for a long time, but I've been really experiencing it more lately, is how every trait that a person has a positive and a negative. Like for someone who is stubborn, well, they're very tenacious and they will get the job done.
Right.
And then on the negative side, it can be frustrating to deal with them. So are we kind of trying to see the benefits and see the good sides? Like as an example, someone who, for me, I'm a very emotional person. And mm-hmm. the good side of that is that I can be very alive and expressive and passionate. And then on the negative end, it can also cause me to be very sensitive and hurt easily. So when I focus on the strength of that aspect of my personality and move more into that instead of thinking, oh, I'm wrong to be so easily hurt. Am I making sense?
Totally. That makes total sense. And that's basically a lot of the philosophy that we talk about, that we focus on what's working and what is your strength. And as we focus on that, the problem becomes less of a problem. You know, so if we take a problem solving mentality, which a lot of maybe self-help thinks about that, or a lot of, you know, business, because it did come out of the business philosophy. So if a business goes, you know, this is a problem, we need to increase our sales, we need to whatever, deal with this problem, and we're constantly thinking about the problem, then we're always tied to the problem. Whereas if we go, what is actually working right now, and how do we make more of that happen so that eventually some of the other things maybe will work themselves out? You know what I mean? So, for example, I thought of the whole idea of asking, like, I have no problems with therapy. Like, therapy is important and it's needed in its own. There are certain times when therapy is very, very important. And this is different. This isn't therapy. But, for example, if someone asks you this question, like, think about it when I ask you this, and notice how it feels when I ask you this question. So the question is, tell me about what's keeping you from being your best self. So how does that make you feel?
It makes me think, wow, I have a lot of issues that I need to work on. I can't be my best self because there's so much wrong with me.
I know. And all of us do that. All of us do that. So what is actually happening is where the question leads us to our problem. And then we're just fixated on the problem. We're trying to think of how am I going to fix this problem? And it keeps us tied there. And then eventually the hope is that we'll figure out what it is, and then we'll move into, living a better life, you know? So it's like it's a bit of a journey to get to where we want to go. Now I'm going to ask you the same question shifted to a more appreciative inquiry kind of type of question. So Oh, and also that first question I asked you has, there's a lot of subtext in it. So the subtext also is that you're not your best self and you're not enough. So that's also hidden in there too, right? So this is the shift in the question. So tell me about a time when you felt like your best possible self. Describe what happened and what influenced you to feel that way. So do you see how that feels different?
Definitely. Yeah, you're forced to think about the good things and to see like, oh yeah, I remember when that happened and then I did this. And I can imagine from like a brain wiring neurobiological standpoint, just bringing up that memory is going to create the positive endorphins and all of those things that were present at that time.
Yes.
So then you're at a different level. It's like Einstein says, no problem can be solved from the same level that it was created. And it seems like that question is shifting the level of consciousness.
Yeah, I like that. Yes, totally. Totally. It's so, there's so much inspiration in that question versus it's really asking the same thing, really, you know. It's a flip side of the same thing, but there's so much, it's so different and it feels so much more free and it feels more inspiring to think about when we were our best self and how do we access that more instead of looking at what are the barriers. And sometimes we need to look at our barriers. I'm not saying that we don't want to live. It's not about having rose colored glasses and pretending everything's perfect when they're not. So sometimes we do have to address barriers. That is the reality. But when we approach that first, it's so defeating right off the bat. And then we just go, oh, there's too many things. I'm just going to stay the way I am. You know what I mean? Versus, you know, wow, there's already a positive momentum happening. How do we like get on that? How do we just, you know, let that flow better, you know, and just create a better flow?
I love that.
So yeah, I started to mention the five principles. And then, so there is a process of appreciative inquiry that you do within a team. And it's the five D's. But it's only a piece. So it's also like the whole idea and philosophy around it. And that can influence an organization or an individual as much as going through the actual process. But so the principles are the constructionist principle. And basically that is, you know, words create worlds. So, and I love, I don't know if I can repeat the quote very well without, it's a Martin, oh, forget it. I don't know the quote. I'll send it to you and you can post it. It's basically as you're speaking, you're creating something. So like, as we speak, we're creating our reality. And I don't think we think about that often. And we start talking about things in a really negative way. And we're actually creating our own reality by doing that. So if we switch our language and start being more cognizant about the power behind language, it can change so much in our lives. So like within an agency or an organization, we co-create together our reality when we use common positive language. Coming from mental health and the health community, there's so much negative language that gets used there around people, like, you know, this person's manipulative, you know, like using language like that. And it can be so destructive, not just to the person who's receiving services, but it also is destructive to the team. And instead of using language like that, using kind of flipping it around and say, this person really knows how to get what they want. And let's maybe support them to find what they want in maybe a healthier way. You know, that's a way to kind of reword it. So yeah, and then the next principle is the simultaneity principle. So And that basically means that the moment we start asking a question, a change starts happening. So whether that's a positive question or a negative question, a change starts the moment the question is said. That's powerful. Were you gonna say something?
No, I was just saying, ooh, I was just getting excited. That was a big one.
And then the poetic principle, and that's like what we focus on expands, so we can find whatever we want to find. So I don't know if you have ever experienced this, but years ago, I had this green Toyota Tercel, and it was like an apple green color, like very, very bright green. And I had never noticed one before on the road, never. But as soon as I bought my own, I noticed them all over the place. They were all over the place. So, you know, we will see what we want to see. And if we want to see, so if I want to notice green cars, I'll notice green cars. If I want to see the bad in everyone and see what's not working, then I will see that. If I want to see the positive, if I want to notice the gold in other people, if I want to see what is your strength, what do you bring to the table that no one else does, if I want to see that, then I will see it. But if we don't go into relationship, into our organizations with that kind of attitude, we're not going to. So I think that's really powerful. And, you know, the whole idea, do we want to study? Do we want to figure out, like, do we want to study and delve into moments of stress or moments of intense negativity? Or do we want to study creativity and innovation? So what do we want to spend our time focusing on? Because what we focus on will expand. So this is powerful. And then the fourth one is anticipatory principle. So that's imagine inspires action. So it's really about hope. So we create images of our future. So if we are focused on something good, we're going to create something good. It's not to say that bad things happen. And that certainly happens. Like, we have setbacks all the time and negative things happen, but it's how we choose our response to those things that really influences where we're going to go. Because people, like, if you look at people who are successful in business, people who are successful in whatever undertakings they do, there's something that's different about someone who's successful versus someone who's not, or an organization that's successful versus someone who's not. And I really don't think, like, that it's necessarily that someone is more talented than someone else. And there may be that, but you go, you know, walking down the street of Vancouver sometimes, and there's some buskers that are on the street, you know, singing, that are just as good as some of the artists you hear on the radio. You know, what is it that makes it different for someone? Like, is it the fact that we have this incredible sense of hope that's propelling us forward? Is that one of the things that kind of differentiates where we end up? I don't know. So it's the anticipating something, I think, has a real powerful effect on where we end up. And then the fifth one is the positive principle. So just focusing on the positive core, focusing on what's positive has an upward spiral versus, you know, the negative has a downward spiral. And it really does create an energy. You know, when we think about the negative, it propels us down. And I know for me, like, I've said this in the last interview I had with you, like, I can lean towards kind of depression. That can be something that can be hard for me. So if I start thinking that negative, those negative kind of feelings and thoughts, it can really start to suck me down. And the principle is the same. When we think positively, it can start propelling us up. So yeah, it's kind of fascinating to me. And then the last one is the wholeness principle. And that's about how sometimes we focus on the individual part without realizing the whole. So there's many pieces to the whole. So sometimes, like, if we think about football, we think about within football, there's competition, but there's also community and connection, and there's working together and all that stuff. So if we focus on just the competition piece, we're missing the rest of it. I'm not a sports person, but this is an example. Or I have a quote about Albert Einstein about this. It's funny that you mentioned him already. So he marveled about magnetic fields, gravity, inertia, light beams. So something deeply hidden had to be behind these things, he said. So he retained the ability to hold two thoughts simultaneously and to be puzzled when they conflicted and to delight when they saw underlying unity. And for that, sometimes I think, and this is a small way that language shows up for me. We tend to go, there's an either or. This is right and this is wrong. And our brains really kind of go, it's really hard to kind of piece it together. But what if there's a both and? So kind of changing our language instead of either or. Well, what if both are right? Does it have to be an either or? Can it be both and? And I think that really illustrates this principle, is that sometimes it's bigger than we can see, and maybe both interpretations are right. And I think we live in a culture where there's very much an attitude that one thing is right and one thing is wrong. And this is really about balancing different perspectives. And it's not necessarily that one is right and one is wrong. It's just, it's different. And how can we work towards it to see the greater whole? You know what I'm saying? So.
Oh. I was noticing the positive and the negative. You also mentioned a little earlier about how things in life, setbacks are going to happen, challenges are going to happen, and we can look at the negative side of it. If mm-hmm. there's an injury or a financial, something came up for me, this financial situation. It was really a consequence, and I felt like I was being punished. And I was kind of trying to stay positive about it. So I was like, okay, this feels really bad, and I'm not going to let it get me down. I'm not going to let this be the reason that I spiral down into depression. Mm-hmm. But then I was able, through talking it out and I did some mirror work, I got to the point where I was able to say, okay, actually, this is a natural consequence of me not facing my fears around finances. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to get down on myself for that mistake, because I did the best that I could with the knowledge that I had. Mm-hmm. And I'm also going to use this as a learning opportunity, because now that I've really felt the consequence, I'm like, it feels like it's stabbing through my gut. But maybe I needed that consequence to really get that lesson.
Yeah. Yeah, that's amazing. That is so amazing. I totally agree with you. And I think sometimes, I think it's important to validate pain and loss and hurt. And I think sometimes we need to also be aware of our dissatisfaction when there's things that we're unhappy about, because that can propel us to move forward and propel us to have the desire and the motivation to change things. So I think it's also, I think it's not about ignoring those things, but it's about, like you said, it's about changing our attitude towards them. And what can I learn from this? And how can I apply it or do things differently so that it doesn't affect me the same way next time? Or maybe I don't have a next time. You know, I think that's really powerful, because yeah, bad things are going to happen. And it's about, in a way, sometimes, I don't know if this is necessarily appreciative inquiry, but really, when you think about it, just situations are situations, and we apply meaning to it based on how we interpret it. So if you go, like, the way you applied meaning to that after you thought about it, there's a lot of learning in it. And it's actually, sure, it's not something you want to happen all the time, but what can I learn about it? And what's the good within this that that I can bring forward in my life? And most people, if you figure out, most people who've figured out what their why is And what I mean by why is like, what is your sense of purpose that's propelling you in life? What gives you the motivation to do whatever it is you do? Most people who've discovered their why, it often comes out of some kind of heartbreak or some kind of difficulty. So that to me is powerful, because it's like, this can actually, if we look at it a little different, these really harsh, hard moments that we go through can be a rebirth almost. So it's like, how do we look at those moments as, you know, and sure, we have to sit in it sometimes. We have to sit in that muck sometimes. You know, sometimes that's part of the process. It's just like, I feel awful. But we don't want to stay there. And how do we propel, like, use the energy to look at things different and move us forward? So, yes. And I think, you know, again, back to the global picture that we were talking about, how it can get really... I know in the last 6 months, there's been so many horrific events that have happened, and it can start to feel like, what is happening with this world? Is it, you know, is the apocalypse happening soon? You know, it can get feel really suffocating. But I think when we start to think about the, like you said, the small moments when individuals, when we approach our day and something bad happens, something comes our way that is not necessarily what we want. If we choose to look at it a little bit differently, it's like the domino effect. So if we look at our attitudes at work or at home or in our communities, and we look at our attitudes and try to look at things from a more strength-based perspective rather than a negative perspective, rather than, oh, that person's such an idiot, you know, and starting down that rabbit trail, and instead looking to see, you know, what's the bigger picture here? What am I not seeing? Maybe there's this person, sure, it was kind of rude what happened, but maybe there's something else that I don't know. As we start to shift our thinking that way, it will have a cumulative effect in our own lives, so that we change the way we approach life, but then it affects other people around us. And I think slowly we can transform our surroundings when we start to transform ourselves, you know, and especially in a workplace. And that's, you know, the next piece of appreciative inquiry is what they call like a summit. So it's like a group of a team would gather and go through the process of doing an inquiry. And that can be so powerful to work through that together. And there's the five D's, they call it. So you'd spend like 2 days together, and it can be really, really fun, because it's about finding the fun, right? So having fun is a big piece of it. And sometimes I think in life we can think that fun is frivolous and not important, especially like at work. It's like production, we need to be productive. We need to, you know, get things done and don't waste any time and all that kind of stuff. But having those moments of fun at work are so huge, so huge at creating a great culture within the workplace. Yeah. So I could say the five D's.
Sure. Yeah, that'd be great.
So the five D's are defining. So you want to define what the inquiry is going to be about, and discover. So it's about asking the questions. So the way it works is people get grouped into small groups, and then they're paired up. So if you and I were on a team together and we were paired up, we would have a question, and it would be similar to the question that I asked. So you can create a question based on what you want to get out of the inquiry. So if you want to find people's passion at work, then you could ask a question like, so I would ask you the question, tell me a time when you felt the most passionate about your job, say, or when you felt the most lit up in your work. And then you would tell me the story, and I would write it down. So I would record it, and I'd ask you there's lots of questions that I would ask you to kind of draw you out. And then I would record it, and then you would ask me the question. So then we're sharing together, and there's something really powerful in that. And then we would go to the bigger group and share what we came up with. So then I would talk about what you said, and you would talk about what I said. And there's something so fabulous about that when you hear someone else reflect back what you said, and it feels so validating. So it's a really cool piece. And then throughout there, then you find some themes, you find common themes through other people's stories. So then you kind of figure out what you want to focus on. So then the next D is dream. So then you find, you know, commonalities in everyone's stories, and you figure out what you want. What's your dreams for the organization? And it's always an appreciative inquiry. It's always about the present and the future, because in visioning and vision statements and stuff like that, it's usually very top down and it's very future focused. And with appreciative inquiry, it's the whole organization. So everyone from the CEO to the people that clean the facility. So it's like everybody's involved in it. And it's from that level. So it's not something that's top down. So so the whole group decides what do we want to work on now and in the future. So that's an important piece. And then designing it, and then destiny, and yeah. So those are all the D's.
Wow, I love that. That's so awesome. We are running out of time. It has been such a pleasure speaking with you. I have so many questions and I've learned so much from you. Wherever you're listening from, thank you for being with us today. Let's shine more light on the world, because we definitely need it. And I'm just feeling like all of this struggle, that the planetary struggle, is really an opportunity for more and more people are starting to shift their perspective. Every day you start hearing about, oh wow, I've had an attitude change and I see things differently. And it takes sometimes being in that fear and that anger and really feeling the pain of it to realize that we don't want to come from that place anymore.
Yeah. I think along those lines is like when we actually look at these really horrific events that happen, it is fascinating to hear about all these amazing people that come together and support people and support the community and the love that can come out of that. So I think, how do we create the world that we want to live in? And it starts with today. It starts with what we do today.
Thank you so much for being with us. So you can go to my website, mariebenard.com. You can go to Jen's website, luminatewellness.com. And I want to send lots and lots of love. Be well. I love you so much. Namaste. Mm-hmm. Up next is Parts Unknown with DJ Chris Arific on CITR.
Hey, why so sad?
Oh, nothing really.
Not very convincing, Jane girl. Whatever it is, I've got just the cure for it.
One, two, three, four.
Did you know CITR has a women's collective? This brand new collective is all about providing and fostering a community for women who are or who want to be in radio, fighting the gender disparity in media, and centering women's voices and issues. If you are a female-identified person or ally who's already involved in radio or wants somewhere to start, this collective is for you. Email womenscollective@citr.ca for more information and to get involved.
And tune in Friday at 6 p.m. for the collective show, Lady Radio, featuring music, interviews, events, news, commentary, basically anything we care to talk about.
See you then.
Well, how do you like it?
There's only one word for it. Terrific.
You know, I'm so proud of it, it's almost indecent of me.
Are You Aware Radio, alternate Thursday 6 to 7 p.m. at CITR 101.9 FM. Profiling music and musicians take the route of positive action over apathy.
A new festival. festival of exploratory music and sound, Tidal Signal, aims to highlight women, transgender, genderqueer, and intergender artists working in left-field genres. The inaugural Tidal Signal will feature an array of musics encompassing noise, ambient, electronic, drone, experimental techno, improvised, sound, and performance art.
The lineup features Kiran Boomer,
Laura Lowe, Sarah Gold, plus Emily Thacker, Weiser, Sasha Mannequin, Brady Marks, Massey plus Marina, Mass Marriage, Opponent Processes, Orkana, and Prophecy Sun.
Evenings of